Oh boy, where do I even begin today? I've never had so much neon in my house before. G'day, Burton. We are going to talk about my wires too, since you've raised some concerns on that. I'll tell you where I'm going to begin today. I'm going to begin today where I normally begin, which is to click the little button which tweets and says I'm live. We've got to remember to do that. And then the other bit that I normally begin with is around sponsors as well, because I do like to give the sponsors a shout out at the start. And it is a brand newie this week. It's Aptrana, a risk-based managed cloud WAF, web application firewall, that includes security assessments of your site, instant managed protection, 24/7 monitoring and CDN. So a big thanks to Aptrana. It's always nice to have a new sponsor on board as well. I think what's starting to happen is a lot of organizations are starting to go, we got to do things differently. We're not going to go back to doing normal conferences and traveling around and standing on stages and things like that. So I feel like there's been this, like Corona started and everyone was just like, holy shit, what's going to happen? And everything kind of slowed down a little bit. And it just really feels like things are picking back up again. And I think sort of having sponsors come forward and go, okay, look, let's just get on with business, get online, start promoting our things and being visible again is probably a positive sign that we're just moving on with life. So thank you to Aptrana for this week's sponsorship. I hope this has been a good week for them. There has been a blog post, which has been getting quite a bit of traction today as well, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later on. Now, where do I begin? I will come back to the blog post, but I seem to be delving into the realms of IoT a lot lately. And I have found that from time to time in these weekly updates, it has consumed rather a lot of time. So I'm going to talk about that. But I want to remind myself, don't let me forget, I've got to drop within about an hour because I am doing a keynote for NetGuru today. So NetGuru is running their Burning Minds event online. And I have a keynote to do for that. I have a shiny PowerPoint deck all ready to roll. It's always a little bit different doing keynotes and talks and things remotely. As a speaker, it's kind of strange because you don't get any of the feedback from people. Like I can't look at people around the audience and sort of see their reactions. But fortunately, I usually have a pretty good idea of how people are going to react. So hopefully I will be right and today's presentation will go down just fine. Now, I just saw a comment there. Is that why you don't have a beer? Yes. Yes, it is why I don't have a beer, so that I can stay sharp. Incidentally, just for folks that are wondering, when I do any sort of conference talk, I have a really, really clear sort of structure that I go through. And depending on what it is, if it's all new content, I'll just rehearse it over and over and over and over again. But one thing that I've been doing for years, which has worked really, really super well for me, is I put everything in terms of the section. So for example, today's talk has got an intro, some stuff on have I been pwned, some hackers. I don't want to blow the whole story here, but other things in here. And what I do is I put each one of these logical sections, which might be three slides, a dozen slides, whatever, I put them as an exercise in an exercise app called Seconds. Now, the reason I do that is I'll show you what it ends up looking like. When I start, and I go start like this. Okay, so I'm holding up my app to the screen here. So what you'll be able to see with the app is that it's counting down and it says that I've got 1 minute and 20 seconds left for my intro. And then it says up next, HIBP. And that is going to be 4 minutes and 23 seconds. And I put this on a stage, or in this case, I'm just going to whack it in front of me in the computer. And then as I'm talking, I can see that countdown and I know that that's how long I've got to finish this module so I can start the next one on time. And I get these times usually right just by rehearsing over and over and over again. And what it means is, particularly for an event that's online and they're doing all this stuff back to back, when they say I've got an hour, it's like I will be 60 minutes, not 59 minutes, not 61 minutes, I will be 60 minutes. And I track it by this. And then I think what does take a little bit of practice is being able to speed up or slow down when necessary, not necessarily with your speech, but like embellish or chop stuff out. So that's how I do things for today as well. I actually have pieces of paper in front of me with like which slide number I should be on at which time. And that just helps me stay on track of things and it helps organizations like NetGuru run their stuff on time. Okay, so reminder not to dive too far down into the IoT rabbit hole today. Now, just looking at some of the comments here. Vijay, quick question. What would be your advice for someone who is starting with creating learning content online, be it on YouTube or any other medium? Good question. I think just doing stuff over and over and over again and just practicing and refining. So I find, like, if I think about all the Pluralsight stuff I did, I noticed today it was 47 Pluralsight courses I've done. I just refined and refined and refined. Like, each one I found little things to make better and better. And even if you look at things like these weekly videos, go back and look at the early ones compared to the ones now. And it's everything from refining, obviously, the environment here to the camera setup to my delivery to the fact that I now do them live instead of pre-recorded. So I think the best thing for any of us and all the things we do is you get to have that process of continual iteration and improvement. Oh, how else we got here? Frederick, good morning from somewhere that sounds like it looks Norwegian. That's nice. Hi from the UK. What else is on here? Well, yeah, I was wondering the beer. Yeah, I'll make up for it later. Don't you worry about that. Greetings from Norway, Sweden. What did I miss about Cisco? Who knows? Let me move on. All right, let me talk about the IoT thing. Oh, boy. Good news on the garage door. That's all working beautifully. And in fact, what's really, really nice about it now is because it is integrated into HomeKit, if I hold my watch up, I've got to put it near my face and then it goes off. This does not work good in demo mode. But anyway, into HomeKit, garage door in there, it is closed. I click a button, garage door opens. I can talk to the lady on the watch whose name I won't mention at the moment, or else she wakes up and starts doing stuff, which works great. When I'm driving in the car, I've got CarPlay in the car, so I can literally just hands on the steering wheel, eyes on the road, ask for the garage door to be open as I approach the house. It's awesome. I'm going to do some video of it later on. When I'm on my bike and I'm riding home, I can easily open the door. So everything there is working really, really well in door land. And if you recall, I put one of the little Shelly relays on the door. So that works great. Now, everything went downhill a little bit yesterday when the professional electrician, and he's a really good bloke too, and I want to talk a little bit about needing licensed electricians and so on here in Australia. So had the, we'll call him the Sparky, had the Sparky over yesterday doing a whole bunch of stuff. Now, I've put out a bunch of tweets today as well, so if anyone wants to see what this actually looks like, let me start with the easy bits. So I've removed a whole bunch of the halogens from the roof. So these are the downlights. They sit in a 90mm hole. I've shown them on this video before. A whole bunch of those have been chopped out of the roof in the kids' bedroom, in a little media center between them, and downstairs in the entertainment room where I have the TV and everything. And the reasons for this is I'm doing a few little mods to the house downstairs. I wanted to get new lights in, just lights that are going to be cozier. The kids' room, I wanted to get rid of the halogens anyway, seemed like a good excuse to put some RGBs in there. So these are RGB LEDs that are internet controllable. So I've tweeted a few photos of that and tweeted a little bit of video. Now, it does look like a bit of a brothel at the moment. Let me rephrase it. It looks like what I imagine a brothel would look like, given all the red light that's there in the rooms at the moment. But most of this was, I was just putting on weird lights because when the kids got six lights in each room, when I put the six down lights in and connected them all, I had to figure out which ones are which because there will be a time where I want to make the lights look different at different points in the roof. That was a bit of a back pedal, wasn't it? And I also just realized I said my kid's room looks like a brothel. Anyway, those lights went up in the ceiling quite okay. So what Tim the Sparky has done is he's basically just chopped off the old converters, which would convert the 240 volt through to 12 volt then into the halogens. And now they literally have the same sort of power sockets you'd find on a wall and all of the LEDs just plug into that then up into the roof. Have a look at the tweets from today and you'll see what I mean. So that's great. They're all in the Tuya app. The Tuya app works fine. It allows you to change color and brightness on, off, all this sort of thing. So far, so good. The bit that I have to try and do next is Tuya will automatically expose these things in Home Assistant, which is good because that's sort of my hub. But it looks like a bunch of the Tuya lights that have come through to Home Assistant don't have the ability to adjust color. So Home Assistant doesn't seem to be recognizing that these have color adjustment. And then the other thing is that Tuya can reflect these lights through into Amazon Echo, which I want because the kids have got a little echo, one of the little dots in each of their rooms so that they can ask Alexa to change colors, make lights brighter and all this sort of thing. Now, when it goes from Tuya directly into Alexa, no problems. It goes in there as a colored light and you can go into the Amazon app and change the colors or you can ask Alexa to change them. Problem is that when they go from Tuya into Home Assistant doesn't recognize them as being colored. And then Home Assistant has an integration back to Alexa, which then surfaces them from Home Assistant into Alexa and they go in there without colors. And for some reason, like one of them has gone in from Tuya into Alexa, and then all the others have gone in from Home Assistant into Alexa. So when I ask Alexa to make, say, my son's room red, one light goes red and all the others don't. This is the rabbit hole that I'm in now. It's kind of crazy. So that was the first bit. Now, just looking at some of the comments here. Okay. There's a question here, did Tatham end up helping you? So Tatham Oddie is a mate of mine who's exceptionally smart at basically everything. And he is one of the people that really got me into Home Assistant. And yes, he did actually help me with a bunch of things. So I have been leaning on him a little bit too. As Ian says, try integrating Tuya with Home Bridge next to Impossible. So I don't think I should need to, but we'll see. We'll see. Now, that was that bit. The other bit, which was my big goal, was to get the Shellys. So these are these simple little relays, $25 for one of these relays. You can fit them in behind a PowerPoint. I wanted to put two of them downstairs in my media room. Now, one of them will do the lights on the roof. Another one will do a Philips Hue light strip that goes around a big mirror we just got. And the idea was is that we could control either of those digitally or kinetically via the physical switches on the wall. This is the value proposition of the Shelly. Now, I shared some video and some photos yesterday of this. And long story short, we've got the Shellys working digitally, which is great, but it's not working with the physical switches. Electrician can't figure out why. I can't figure out why. We've taken video. We've put video up. And holy shit, did we get some responses. So one of the responses, one of the themes of response was a lot of people were absolutely appalled at the wiring. Now, what I think we're seeing here more than anything is a difference in how the wiring is done in Australia versus in other parts of the world. And it sounds like in places like Europe and the UK, they have these gang boxes where there is a physical plastic box behind the wall and all the wiring sits in there. And it looks like a lot of plastic conduit as well. Not so much in Australia. Now, with the caveat that this is a renovated house that would have been renovated well before I bought it, something like 13 years ago. So not super old, but not super modern either. And the original house, I suspect, was more like 25 or 30 years old. Can't really be any more than that because there was literally water here before that. This is reclaimed land. I wonder how much of this is legacy or not, but basically in all the houses that I've seen houses being built as well, the wires are run through, often through holes in the studs as opposed through conduits, and they end up coming down and then straight into the back of whatever wall plates go on. Now, there are no live wires floating around inside there. The points do go into the sockets on the switches and the light bulbs and this sort of thing, but it's not sitting inside plastic boxes. Now, what makes it particularly messy downstairs in the photos there is that for reasons I will never understand, when this place was renovated, they've just got so many switches that seem to be just ridiculously redundant. So a good example, like take a room like this. This is like a normal sized bedroom that I use as a study. We've got a spot down there between the kids' room that's half the size of this. There's four lights on the roof. So let's imagine fragrance sake is about 3 meters by 2 meters. Four lights on the roof. They're on two different circuits. Because maybe you want to turn the two lights on that side of the room on, but not the two lights on the other side of this tiny, tiny room. I don't know why they do that. So that's crazy. And then the other thing that's crazy is that there are a lot of two and three-way switches where there's like one light, but there's three different switches in different places to turn it on or off. Now, sometimes that makes sense. Like I've got a whole bunch of lights that go up and down the stairs and it's like a three-story place. So there's one at the bottom, one in the middle, one at the top. No problems. But downstairs where I took the video, we ended up with so many different switches and things that were already there, already wired in, all meeting Australian compliance too. Like, let's be clear, this is not like me trying to just have a go at it myself. It's just such an overkill of wires and switches and things like that. And in fact, one of the big things that I've said to the Sparky is I want to simplify stuff. So for example, down in the living room or in the entertainment room, which we're doing, there are like six lights on the roof and two different switches. So that you, in fact, it was worse than that. There were six lights in like a pattern and then one just sitting out on its own. And there were three different switches. So I was like, all right, get rid of the one on its own. We'll keep the six. We'll put them all on the one switch and basically simplify a whole lot of stuff. But we're working with all these legacy dependencies in the wall. Now, in Australia, at least, you're not meant to be touching stuff like that unless you're a licensed electrician. And there's no way in the world that I would want to touch that. So this is why I have a professional licensed electrician who's done a bunch of work around the place before that I've been really, really happy with as well. So just to set everyone straight, this is normal in Australia. There's some legacy stuff because of the way this house, I think, has been renovated in the past, and I have a professional working on it. Everyone, calm down. This is the only way we can do this here. So that's the first bit. Now, the next thing is that the Shelly is sending out something like a weird 140 volts from a point that we thought should not have been live at all. Now, we've found a few different references online to this, but as yet, I'm not quite sure what the problem is, and I just haven't had time today to look at it. So what I think I'm probably going to do is just set up my own simple switch on a bench with a light bulb and a Shelly. Like, can I make this work just on a bench with none of the legacy wiring crap inside the wall, not the fancy switch which I've now got on the wall, which has a little LED that lights up when the power's on, any of that sort of stuff. So I'm just going to try and dumb it down to its simplest possible form. Can I get it working? Sparky's going to come back next week to do other stuff anyway, so hopefully I can all get it set up and going properly then. But so far, I'm falling short. I'm falling short of where I want to be with my IoT things. All right, looking at some of the comments here. Afternoon for Australia, very good. RGB's on the PC. Let's make the whole house a PC. Yeah, it's kind of that. It's all the rage now. It says me sitting in my office with my RGBs as an allegedly mature adult. Was there a reason you didn't flash with Tasmodo? Yeah, because I don't want to. Let me expand. And I'm putting this in a draft blog post as well. In fact, what I'm planning to do, I've now turned it into like a five-part blog post about different bits. I don't think for my purposes I need to flash custom firmware onto devices. If I do that, warranty's gone straight away. And a bunch of these lights, I can actually return within 30 days if I don't want them. I just don't want to get into a situation where just to make a light work, I'm flashing custom firmware. I just do not feel good about that path at all. And I appreciate that a lot of people do like doing that. Awesome. Good on you. I'm glad that this is something you enjoy doing, but I don't want to flash firmware on stuff and I don't want to solder stuff as well. There has to be an easier way just to make lights work. excuse me. Let me see what else we got in here. Wait until all your lights magically drop out of tier and you have to re-add them. Yeah. Look, I've had a lot of stuff dropping out of Decons, which Decons does all the Zigbee device management. And I haven't been real happy about Decons losing stuff either. So I do worry a little bit about that. And also, this is partly why I wanted to make sure that certainly in any sort of family area where, say, my parents would be as well, there are physical switches on the wall at work. I'm kind of happy being a little bit more liberal with the kids' room because the kids don't mind mucking around with lights and things like this and talking to an Alexa and that kind of stuff. Okay, the expensive house. What else is in here? Get 2 years support local MQTT. Yeah, I'm not using MQTT with 2 years. I am using MQTT with the Shelly on the garage. That's working pretty well. Now, funnily enough, like I'm looking at my Ubiquiti networking diagram now, and it's interesting. I'm getting up to about 60 IP addresses in the house. It is an interesting diagram now. In fact, when this is, I don't know if it'll ever be done, but when I'm at a suitable stage, I'll send a picture of it. Now, all the lights that I put in the ceiling, and I have put this in the tweet thread, are from Oz Smart Things, and they've ended up being $30. So $30 for, this is 30 Australian bucks. So if we were to put that in GBP, it's around about half that, call it, you know, probably about 14 quid, something like that. All of those go up into the roof, no problems there. I've been buying them in packs of four from Oz Smart Things. I bought a heap there the other day, and they sent me something. They sent me a freebie. We had a little bit of a chat online. They sent me Oz Smart Blinds. And I thought, just for fun, since I've still got a bit of time as well, I'll open this up now and I'll see what's actually in here. But this is meant to be able to control your blinds via a physical unit with a wheel that you can then open things up with. Now, I'm not quite sure where I'm going to put it. Sort of depends on how it actually works. But there should be a little control unit like that, which, based on what I've seen on some of the videos, there's like a little cog inside here with teeth on it, and you can put the cord to your blind through that and instantly connect it. There's a plug. It obviously runs off mains. And that's about it. There's a bit of 3M sticky stuff here. I assume to stick it onto the wall or to bolt it on. And then there's a couple of different gears, by the look of it, for different sorts of cords that might hang down from your blinds. And they got one there as well. I believe this one's meant for when it's like literally just a cord, where this one's like the beaded one, so it can grasp onto that. So this is pretty cool. What I would actually really, really like to do is, in my master bedroom, there's a really big window with blinds on it. And then it looks out over the water and the sun rises there. So I would really love to be able to automate opening that nice and early in the morning, so that the blinds sort of open up and the sunlight comes through. That feels like a bit of a pipe dream at the moment. But then again, at least this is not something you have to wire in. It's like plug it into the power cable and then connect it to the blind and we should be good to go. Now, just notice a comment here. He doesn't use VLANs because that causes all sorts of other issues. I had VLAN on my previous Ubiquiti network. I'm on version 2 of my network now because I rolled over to a Dream Machine Pro and just ended up just redoing everything. Now, I still have an IoT network, a dedicated IoT network. I am putting all of the IoT things on the IoT network. The problem is that once you VLAN stuff, all sorts of things get harder. Everything from pairing a new device onto the network, because often it's going to pair to the network that your device is already on, so you have to keep switching networks, to the fact that there's a whole bunch of devices that do need to actually be able to see from an isolated VLAN back into the primary LAN. So, for example, things like Sonos. So Sonos does allegedly some kind of funky multicast stuff where it needs to be able to actually see the client, and you can't just sit it in a separate VLAN. Not without opening up firewall ports on other UDP, or opening up firewall rules on other UDP ports and things like that. So I've just got to think about whether I want to go down that path again or not. Look, I very possibly will, but I just don't need more stuff to at the moment. At least doing it this way, already having the IoT stuff on a different Wi-Fi network, everything can see each other, but I can now go through and do things like put all the IoT stuff on a different subnet if I want to, because if I keep adding devices, I will start to run out of subnets, IP addresses rather, at some point. So the option is there for the future. Put in the TV room so that when you turn on the TV, the blinds go down. Now, the only thing is I don't actually have blinds in my TV room. So there's big bifold doors which go out to the pool. But I also only watch TV, I only ever watch TV at night, and I very often don't watch TV at all. So that really doesn't worry me too much there. What else we got here? VPNs. Tom, hi from DDoS.nz. Yeah, how's that working out for you, mate? Bought any shares lately? Probably too soon. The other thing that's got to go in there, in fact, this arrived. I didn't show this last week. In my travels, looking for universal remotes, the best one I could find was basically a newer version of what I already had, which was the Logitech Harmony. So this Harmony remote is going to go back into the network. I'm waiting on a new receiver to replace my old one on the home theater setup. And then when I get the new receiver, I'll set this up as well. And the reason I haven't set, in fact, the new receiver's arrived. I just haven't picked it up yet because other stuff is still going on the walls, and then that will change all of the tuning. Why in the hell am I doing all this? It's better be worth it. All right. I'm starting to get a bit sick of IoT, so let me go on to something totally different, which is a blog post that I kind of wanted to write for a little while, and I eventually just got enough of a bee in my bonnet this week that I decided to do it anyway. And this is around disclosure messages for companies that have been breached who talk about your password having been encrypted when it wasn't. Now, this came off the back of seeing someone tweet a message from Wattpad. Now, Wattpad was breached many, many weeks ago now, and they had a very big breach. I think it was about 260 million user accounts, all in Have I Been Pwned Now. And there's a notice here from the Wattpad security team, and they're talking here. They say, and this is in bold, so you know it's important. We want to stress that Wattpad does not store plain text passwords. Okay, very good. All Wattpad passwords are encrypted. No, they're not. They are hashed. They are bcrypt hashed, which is good. Bcrypt is good. But what's interesting here is reading through this, they say, although we use encryption to store passwords, store wrong, as a precaution, we're taking steps to enhance the standards we use for passwords on our platform. All right. If your data was improperly accessed, bad actors could use it to contact you or attempt to gather personal information. Therefore, we are recommending you, and this is in bold again, so that's important, change your password on Wattpad or any other third-party accounts where you use the same password. Now, here's the issue that I have with this. You're left in sort of an awkward position where the organization is saying, we protected your passwords in storage using some sort of methodology. Let's not worry too much about whether it's hashing or encryption. We protected your passwords. By the way, change your passwords. And to me, it just feels like it's in an awkward middle ground because it's like either the passwords were well protected, in which case you don't need to change them, or you need to change them because they weren't well protected. Like, which camp are you going to have a boot in? Now, this is pretty much where we would be with encryption, because if it was encryption, then the question would be, assuming it was good encryption, the question would be, what happened to the private key? Was there a private key disclosure? If they were confident there was no private key disclosure, then all the passwords are good. If they weren't confident there was no disclosure, then none of the passwords are good. Assuming they were just encrypted, even my crazy one password generated password wouldn't be good because it would be decrypted immediately with the key. Now, of course, what's happening here is Wattpad is using language that they're trying to tailor to normal everyday people. And this is the feedback that I keep getting. So I sort of tweeted this, and in my tweet I said, where was my tweet? I said, saying that passwords are encrypted over and over again doesn't make it so. They're bcrypt hashes, so good job there, but the fact they're suggesting everyone changes their password illustrates that even good hashing has its risks. And I think the point I'm trying to make here is I would much prefer an organization to explain what actually happened rather than trying to use language that they think people relate to. So the feedback I kept getting from this is people would say, the reason Wattpad said encryption is because people don't know what hashing is. And I'm sort of going, well, that statement implies that people know what encryption is. I think they know the word, but do they really actually know what it is? So I don't think that using the word encryption and assuming that people know what it means and can take appropriate action as a result does anyone any favors. So I wanted to write something that explained in human readable terms what hashing is. And very, very specifically, I wanted to have a sentence, and I would love organizations to pick this sentence up. And the sentence is this: a password hash is a representation of your password that can't be reversed, but the original password may still be determined if someone hashes it again and gets the same result. And that is literally what a password hash is. Now, to me, this is something which is much clearer than using the word encryption when there was no encryption. I then wrote the blog post and fleshed it out more. In fact, I titled the blog post, "We Didn't Encrypt Your Password, We Hashed It. Here's What That Means." And then it goes through and gives a whole bunch of information about what hashing is. So it's a one-way deterministic algorithm. You can't unhash, but you can take the same input, hash it with the same hashing algorithm, compare them. Here's what you go. If it's MD5, you can put it in a browser and Google it, and if there's no salt, you'll find results for it. I then go down and show, even on the bcrypt front, I pumped a bunch of the Wattpad bcrypt hashes into Hashcat, and sure enough, a bunch of them were cracked. Now, part of the reason they were cracked is because Wattpad's password criteria goes like this. You got six characters? Cool. Like, that's it. Six or more characters. Doesn't matter what sort of composition they are. And of course, composition rules are something that are now remnant of a bygone era anyway. Doesn't matter if the password's been seen a million times before. They will allow it. So at the end of the day, Wattpad's guidance about changing your password is actually pretty accurate, because they allowed people to have passwords which were pretty atrocious and could easily be cracked, not decrypted, cracked. So look, we'll see. I'm sympathetic to what people are saying about encryption being a more recognized term, but I just don't think that saying people understand what encryption is, that's why the word is used, is the right thing. So I would much rather prefer to see the language used, which I have suggested here, but we'll see. We'll see what time brings. Now, I've seen a bunch of comments scrolling through here. How am I going for time? I've got half an hour until I've got to go do this keynote. What else is on here in the comments that's interesting? Lots of IoT stuff. I seriously just need a little bit of a night off the IoT. Mind you, if I want to go down and watch TV, the only way I'm going to be able to turn the bloody lights on are with my phone, because the physical switch doesn't work now, which is very counterproductive to what I was originally after. It's just, obviously, this is related to me talking about people not understanding the word encryption. Shane says, the technical term is moron. Yeah, sometimes I reckon you're right, mate. I reckon you're right. Regarding hashing or encryption, with regards to passwords, if I were to talk to my parents, they would understand encryption, but they would not understand hashing. But would they understand encryption? Would they understand, for example, that there's a key involved? And if the key is disclosed and the encryption is useless? See, I don't think my parents would understand that. I think they are familiar with the term encryption in the context of it as some sort of obfuscated message that can be retrieved again somewhere else. But that would be the extent of it. And I think more importantly, in terms of the purpose of a breach disclosure notice, what will they do with that information? If my parents were told it was encrypted rather than hashed, how would that change their behavior? Or vice versa, how would it change their behavior? Because at the end of the day, Wattpad's guidance here was to go and change your password. Password, the same one that you use everywhere, which again is part of the problem. But that guidance is good. The reason explaining why, I don't think really changes things whatsoever. Matthias, just reset everyone's password. Say sorry, only way to win. The difficulty here is that Wattpad is weighing up a preventative measure, which is what resetting everyone, or forcing reset on everyone's password would be, with the absolute shit fight of a usability nightmare that would then create. Because you've then got a quarter of a billion people who now all have to go and reset their passwords. They come back to Wattpad. They can't log in. The old one won't work. They have to get the email. They have to log back on. And also, they're bcrypt hashes. Bcrypt hashes, work factor 10, maybe a little bit low for today's standards, but still good. With a bcrypt hash, unless you've got a pretty lousy password, it's very unlikely it's going to be cracked anyway. So, you know, not unless someone is specifically targeting you, saying, I know this person uses a small combination of possible passwords. Let's go through and see if it's any of those. But any sort of en masse hash cracking is just not going to happen. Not the same way as it would with MD5 or SHA-1 or something. And just to put it in context, we're talking about tens of millions of times slower to achieve the same hash cracking result with bcrypt as we would be with MD5 or SHA-1. So it's a very, very resilient algorithm. So I feel that going through and resetting everyone's passwords would possibly be a bit overkill, but one would think that Wattpad would at least keep track of who has reset their password, when have they reset it since this incident, and that might be a flag in future if there's any nefarious activity. What else have we got on here? The only thing that really matters is end-user experience, says Shane, and I think end-user experience is enormously important. And it is something that we often neglect in the pursuit of security absolutism. And I've used this term, security absolutism, many times before, because people do get very caught up on, and I guess it's my circles as well, given the thing I do, but they get very caught up on how do you make something as secure as possible And often that is at the detriment of the user experience. And the user experience is the thing that gets people coming back, paying for the service, which pays your wages if you work for a company that works in this space. 2FA is a great example. 2FA is fantastic. Fixes the password problem almost dead. Obviously, there are some gaps in some places in 2FA, but it fundamentally changes the risk. So why don't we force 2FA on everyone? Because it's an absolutely terrible user experience. Now, don't get me wrong. I got 2FA turned on all my things that allow it. But I tell you what, every time I have to try and help my parents get back into an account with 2FA on it, and they don't know if it was a soft token. It was a soft token migrated from your other phone. What do you mean it wasn't a soft token? Was it an SMS? Anyway, it's painful setting up 2FA. So the point there being is that the usability experience is a massive part of it, which is why things like 2FA got such low adoption rates. User experience, what's the problem with having to reset your password for security? Again, I think we sort of covered that. Usability, people will not read the explanation about what hashing means. No, but they don't know what encryption means anyway. So I'd much rather have an accurate thing people don't read than an inaccurate thing people don't read. Shane says, the challenge of the statement is it requires additional time from a user. Isn't it preferable just let the user know that there is a risk exposure? I think where there's some merit in what you're saying there, Shane, is that maybe we just say change your password. You know, we recommend you change your password. We tried to protect it. It got out. We did some other stuff to try and protect it if it got out, but just change your password. But the other thing is, again, that it would be an easier discussion if Wattpad didn't allow such terrible passwords, but they do. I do love when you reset your passwords because you forget, but then you get the you've already used this password and the new one. Yeah. It's just hard, isn't it? The whole thing's a big mess. Tom says, beer fixes all. If you get the chance, try Garage Project Pernicious Weed. I have had a Pernicious Weed before. Big 8% IPA from Wellington. I think I might be into a big 8% double IPA from Pirate Life after I do my keynote. After. It's funny. I have said, I have honestly not done this because, you know, I just drink beer in front of people anyway. But I have seen people in Zoom lockdowns putting their beer or wine in a coffee cup, and it just like in. It's like, yeah, I'm just drinking coffee. So yeah, well, you may also have an alcohol problem. But yeah, good choice, Tom, for the Pernicious Weed. I need a meme to explain hashing. Okay, that's another idea here, which would be another way of doing it, I guess. Look, I think the thing that sort of gets me, particularly with data breaches, is that they're serious incidents. They can have serious legal implications as well. And I feel very uncomfortable with inaccurate or misleading information, particularly when it's used in a way which really doesn't add anything to the experience. The heart of this, again, with the Wattpad thing was change your password if it's a bad one. Now I'm getting thirsty for beer. So James says, we're in the process of integrating Heavy Pwn password check. What are your thoughts on denying a user pick a password that is flagged versus warning? Notice the BBC just warns. So I love that we're having this discussion. I love that we're having the discussion about there are different levels at which you can implement this. I don't think the right thing to do is to outright block every single password on every single service that integrates Pwn passwords. I don't think that's right at all. Now, the BBC, and just to be clear, like the only thing I know about the BBC is what they wrote. I don't know any more about it than you. I haven't sat there and planned this out with them. But if we were to speculate, the BBC has a very consumer-centric audience. They've got a lot of mums and dads and normal people out there who don't understand the security world. You would want to, A, be cautious about the way you explain things such that it doesn't look like the BBC has had a security incident. And B, be conscious that you do actually want people signing up and using your service. And if you create a barrier that is too high, it's going to make life hard for them. So I'd suggest several options here. So one option is what James has said here about just warning them that it's a weak password. Now, that I guess the problem that I have with that is that people don't do real good with just warnings. Although this would be a really interesting thing to A/B test, wouldn't it? It'd be a great A/B test to sort of go, okay, what if we warn for 50% of the audience and then we don't say anything for the other 50% of the audience? Of the 50% that we warn for, what proportion do actually change their password? If you have these stats, I'd be really interested in knowing. The more sort of empirical evidence we can get about user behaviors, frankly, the better. So the first thing is I would consider when to warn versus block versus silently flag. So here's a thought as well. A lot of security teams blow a lot of time trying to help people deal with account takeover. If they had a silent flag on a record, and what I mean by silent flag is that the user never sees anything, but you just flag the record to say, this is a shit part, probably pick a different column name, right? this is a weak password. Now, you don't have to know what the password is. It can be stored as a nice, strong cryptographic hash, good, strong bcrypt hash. But you could flag to say, at the point when this person signed up and we had the password in plain text, we hit have I been pwned's K anonymity API, came back, said it was bad, we're going to flag it. What I would not do is I would not record the number of times the password has been seen before, because that could indicate what the actual password was, thus negating a lot of the value of the protection and storage. What I would consider is having ranges. Now, so imagine this. Let's say you have three different categorizations of bad password. So one categorization is the password's only been seen once or twice. And you say, this is a previously seen password, low risk. If it's been seen anywhere from 3 to 10 times before, medium risk. Anywhere from 11 times or more, high risk. Three different possibilities. And what you do is, first of all, when you're silently flagging a record, you store a 1, 2, or 3 or whatever lookup table you want to make it on the record. So you know how bad that password was, but there's nothing in there that will help you actually figure out what the password really was. And then you can repeat that same methodology as part of the process when people do sign up. So password has been seen once or twice, silent flag the record only. Password has been seen 2 to 10 times. Let's say have the BBC's message. This is a bad password. You probably want to change it. Here's some more reading if you're the type of person that likes to read. Been seen 11 times or more, disallow. That's how I'd go about it. I would try and find where those thresholds are, and I would also try and A/B test it. I would literally have a sample group which just didn't get that experience and a sample group that did, and I'd want to try and quantify what's actually different in the behavior. James, if you do that, let me know, please. I'd love to see those figures. Other comments here. Shane says, you make sense, but what's the next level? If it's consistent word that comes up, I think we're back on the hashing. I think we're probably, you know what? If you've got other thoughts on the hashing thing, leave a comment on the blog post, because there is actually a place there that that people can go and read it. And incidentally, comments on blog posts are great, because everyone who comes back and sees it for the next, you know, 1,000 years or however long it lasts will see those same comments too. Tom says, Troy, you're good at explaining the warnings when integrating the HIB pass. Could it be worth providing some boilerplate warnings that reflect your experience with the password space? So what I've tended to do, Tom, is point people to Stefan from EVE Online. So EVE Online is run by CCP Games. Stefan is an Icelandic bloke. He's someone I've come to know quite well when I used to travel. And EVE Online did a lot of early integration with Have I Been Pwned. Did work quite closely with me and also with Cloudflare as well. And Stefan's put a lot of effort into tweaking the wording and also publishing a lot of blog posts and other information publicly facing, and then doing it in conference talks as well about what their experience has been. So go and Google like Stefan EVE Online pwned passwords and you'll find some really good stuff there. So give that a go. Yeah, you could easily, Gordon says, g'day Gordon, you could also say if it's really high risk, greater than 20 or 50, we can't let you set that password. Yeah, that's kind of the point I was making before. And then Gordon says, okay, you said that. We're sort of out of sync with our thread here. And Nathan is questioning what on earth travel is. I've been in the same bed now for almost 7 months. I've closed my exercise rings every day for, I don't even know how much it is in months. I think it's about 150 days. So that's a nice outcome of not being able to travel anywhere. So look, I'm conscious of time. I've got about 20 minutes where I've got to go and do this keynote, and I need to go and get a cold drink of water. It won't be beer, not yet. Will be beer shortly. And move on with that thing. So look, thank you very much for watching. I'll do this earlier in the day next Friday. I hope I have a happier story about the Shelleys. I think that they are awesome in concept. The execution does seem to be a little bit flaky, but we'll see. We'll see how many more IP addresses I have in my house a week from now. So thanks very much for watching, and I'll catch you next week. See ya.